Hey guys, just before we jump into the episode today, we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast today. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and we extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today. This episode is brought to you by the Psych Collaborative, our online psychology clinic bringing good quality, accessible therapy to you in the comfort of your own home. Hello, everybody. We are back. Welcome back to another episode with the Psychology Sisters. I am Amy, a registered psychotherapist.
And I am Kat, a registered psychologist, and together we are the Psychology Sisters, a podcast dedicated to normalizing the mental health conversation. Darling, sweet Ames, how are you? It's been a while since we've been on the mics.
It's been a hot mini, hasn't it?
It's been a hot mini. How are you?
I am good. I feel like that's very boring to say. I just had to think about it like really quickly. Then, how am I? No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm excited to be back. I feel a little bit nervous. I feel like whenever we take a break, the first podcast back, I feel like a little bit like nervy, excited.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel exactly the same. I feel like any podcast, I still feel nervy, excited. But it's been a while. I think our last potty was, I want to say, end of November last year. So we have been on a little small, longer than expected hiatus. So we are back though. We are ready for 2022. We are excited to get into it. But before we do, Ames, I want to hear your pit and peak.
Pit and peak for the week. I would say my peak has been that I have moved closer to the beach, which has been wonderful and such a long time coming. So that has been so great. And I would say my pit would be that I currently have tonsillitis. So every word is like a little dagger in the throat, but that's fine. We're committed. And I have a little bit of rest coming up after this podcast. So yes, mild inconvenience, I would say. What about you, my dear friend? What is your pit and peak?
Just making it through. You're like, every word is daggers, but must do. This is the dedication we have for you guys. Bless you, Ames. Oh, my pit and peak. So obviously I was reflecting on this and there's been a lot of time in between our last podcast. 3 months is a lot of pits and a lot of peaks. I would say though that during my break, I did run off and get married finally. So that was so lovely that I could finally, after a very long 3 years, make it down the aisle and finally tie the knot. So that was so lovely. It was honestly the best day of my life. I feel like I hear people say that, and that's actually really high expectations to put on one day. But yeah, I think it was really, really worth the 3 years of stress, and man, the 2 weeks beforehand was like no other. So it was very much worth the stress and the anxiety and the sleepless nights to go ahead with that day. So it was very special. It was such a wonderful, love-filled day. So I had the best time. So that would definitely be my peak. My pit though would be that, yeah, leading up to the wedding, I experienced so much anxiety. I don't usually experience too much anxiety. I mean, sure, here and there, but I have never felt that level of extreme anxiety. And it was really, I really struggled. I really honestly struggled leading up to the wedding. I just wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating, which is really out of character. I really struggled, like from a mental health viewpoint. I was really, really struggling. Yeah, in the lead up to the wedding. So I was, yeah, really happy to have gone through the wedding and not feel that anymore. But yeah, I haven't really heard many other people. I know it's stressful leading up to a wedding, but I don't know if mine was just more severe or if it wasn't really spoken about to that extent. I haven't heard that it was to the point of that level of stress. So yeah, that was really challenging, to be honest, to work through. And I'm just very glad that I'm a little bit more back to normal now.
Well, me too. It was super stressful. And you were mentioning, Kat, how it would be good to do an episode on that whole experience, because like you said, it was, I guess, in the lead up, you have these expectations of what you think planning a wedding is going to be like, and how a lot of people say it's the most magical, amazing day of your life. But not many people talk about, I guess, a couple of weeks, like what you experienced leading up to the magical event, which can be super isolating and really daunting and consuming and overwhelming, all of the things that you experienced, which I'm so glad you're feeling back to your healthy self and you're able to reflect on the day as being one of the best days of your life or the best day of your life. And it was such a beautiful day. It was Kat, like I know everyone says this about their best friend, but Kat was literally the most beautiful bride I've ever seen.
I think you're a bit biased there, eh?
No, even when you were getting down and dirty on the dance floor, dropping it low, I was like, oh my goodness. And it was just such a love-filled day. I think everybody just felt this warm energy. And I think too, because it was such a long time coming, everyone was just so stoked for you both that like it was finally here. Like I feel like being a guest there, everyone really felt that, which I think made it super like moving and emotional. Like I'm getting a little bit teary thinking about it. Weird. But yeah, absolutely. I think when you've had 3 years to plan the wedding too, it's like 3 years of pent up anxiety and stress and expectation. Yeah. So that was probably super overwhelming and consuming.
Yeah, no, thank you, Ames. That's so sweet. Yes, it was a wonderful day, and a special shout out to Ames. Ames delivered a wonderful speech, best maid of honor. Highly recommend. Kidding. A maid of honor that is a therapist, because damn, that certainly came in handy. You're the best maid of honor, and your speech was incredible. So,
thank you for sharing such a special day.
But yeah, I really think an episode, I don't know if anyone would be interested in that. If you are, slide into our DMs, an episode around marriage, wedding, all of those things, because I really personally found that so challenging. And yeah, I wonder if anyone would feel the same or something like that, particularly compounded by COVID postponements. I wonder, I'm sure other people feel the same way. So yeah, I'd love to do a little ep on weddings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be really, really interesting and helpful to anyone out there that has had a similar experience.
Yes. Also, I had a quick question from a few of my clients. For anyone playing at home, I did wear both dresses. I've had so many questions from my beautiful clients, like, tell us, did you wear the first dress or not? We've been following. I'm like, yes, I didn't realize so many people were interested in the dress saga, but yes, I did wear both dresses. So very luckily, it all went smoothly. Thank God.
And they both look banging. Mwah, chef's
kiss.
Thank
you. Mwah, bellissimo. All right, guys. Well, we will jump into today's episode. Today, we are talking all things financial self-care. Ames, why did we decide this? Why did this come up? Why is this important, do you think, to talk about?
Good question. I think financial self-care is critical to talk about and to understand as any other dimension of well-being, yet it's so often overlooked. I think money and finance is something that we don't often feel overly comfortable talking about, but it plays such a huge part in our overall well-being. I think we decided to do this episode because around the beginning of the year, we make a lot of money goals. We talk a lot about perhaps financial planning for the year ahead. We also come off the back of quite an expensive time of year. So just after Christmas, coming into the beginning of the year, I know for myself, I've had so many bills pop up in the last month after a really expensive kind of holiday festive season. And it is so natural and normal to experience a little bit of money stress or financial stress from time to time. And so we thought this was a really timely episode, perhaps just after maybe you have set some financial goals or done a little bit of financial planning, some budgeting for New Year, and perhaps some financial stress is creeping in, and perhaps financial self-care is not something that you've ever heard of before, because money isn't always talked about, I guess, with the same openness as ease as other parts of self-care.
Yeah, really well put, Ames. There is this stigma perhaps around what self-care actually looks like. And for a lot of people, it is that maybe the more reactive self-care of organizing something in response to a stress, right? Like if you're feeling overwhelmed or stressed, then what are your self-care practices? And I think there's a difference with the proactive side of self-care, which is the financial self-care. Like self-care isn't always glamorous. I think maybe there is this glamorized version of self-care. I know we've spoken about this before, but there's also this other side to self-care, you know, that there is the difficult side to self-care. Self-care, you know, may not be immediately gratifying. It may not fill your cup up straight away. It can be sometimes difficult things that we need to do that benefit us more in the long term. And that can be things like, you know, apart from financial care and in caring for your finances, it can be tough conversations, setting boundaries, saying no, exercising control, sacrificing short-term goals for longer-term goals. And I think financial self-care falls into the more proactive side of self-care and the side that isn't as glamorous or as fun or as exciting as maybe the more reactive self-care, like your massages, you know, your relaxing leisure time. But self-care encompasses both of those things, you know, the instant gratification, the things that help us in the short term, but also things that help us in the long term. And you're spot on, financial anxiety is a real thing, and often it's not usually spoken about as much. You know, money, maybe you can speak about it. Like, I know all groups are different, all friendship groups, in your relationships, how often you speak about money. That's still kind of becoming maybe a bit more normal and mainstream. But what about the anxiety that follows your money and your finances? That's, you know, another thing that isn't really spoken about. So we thought this was such a topical thing to be speaking about at the moment because, yeah, as Ames said, it's a really expensive time of year. I don't know if you feel this, Ames, but there's lots of social events coming up because of the COVID backlog, and there's almost like a lot of things as well on top of the, you know, holidays, all those normal things that happen at the beginning of the year. So it's usually quite a stressful time. I've noticed with some of the clients that I work with, they feel this financial stress at the moment coming off the back of festive season and social season. So it is such a good time to be speaking about this and a good time to be exploring this at the moment. All right. So Ames, we've really outlined why it's important, but what is financial self-care? Talk to me about what that looks like.
I think financial self-care involves having rituals and habits that allow us to look after our finances. I think part of financial self-care is creating healthy financial boundaries, like you're explaining, Kat, to advocate for yourself, what you need and what you value. Because our relationship with money is so strongly linked to self-worth, financial self-care can essentially play a huge role in cultivating healthy self-esteem. When we have poor financial boundaries, it can create a lot of stress. As we were mentioning, we have a lot more social events and things coming up, and that maybe conflicts with some things that we really value or we might be trying to prioritize. This can have a real accumulative effect. For example, we might begin self-medicating with food, spending a lot of money on things for that instant gratification, as you were talking about, Kat, or even going out and buying a lot of drinks that may not necessarily align to our values. So when spending money functions to reduce and cope with stress by engaging in self-soothing behaviors such as perhaps overspending, socializing to avoid things, it can become quite a vicious cycle where we learn to rely on these temporary highs that in the short term do make us feel good because we have been able to get the relief from the uncomfortable or stressful experience without really understanding and developing effective ways of coping. So I think financial self-care, as Kat was explaining, is a really proactive approach for what can be essentially a case of chicken or the egg. You know, is it money that is causing me stress, or am I stressed because of my maybe unhealthy financial habits? So developing a really good financial self-care routine or practice habits is really important because it allows us to reach not only our financial goals, but to really cultivate a sense of empowerment. So I think it's important because essentially we can affect a lot of positive change over our overall well-being by really understanding our relationship with money, how we use our money, the beliefs and values we have associated with money. I think another important part of self-care that you touched on, Kat, is our relationships with others too. So like our friends, our intimate partners, family members. I think it's so important to understand and nurture financial self-care because it's one of the most common experiences we have, yet, you know, ironically, something that we don't often tend to talk about. And I think a lot of interpersonal conflict arises out of differing expectations around money, especially in our intimate relationships. A lot of couples that I work with, money is quite a common prickling point. essentially, where we might have differing spending habits or different values around money. So I think it's important to understand your relationship with money and how it affects you, not only for your own kind of financial self-care, but also for the financial expectations that you might have around others, and I guess wants and needs in interpersonal relationships as well. But I guess going into or speaking of relationships with money, Kat, what impacts our relationship with money and spending?
Good question. I think money isn't just money, right? I feel like money is our sense of control. Money can be stability. Money can be instability. Money can be a loss of control. I think a perceived sense of control with our money will provide the benchmark for stability and security. And so therefore, on the flip side, if we feel we have a loss of control with money, and we're not talking amounts here, I think we're talking about our perceived loss of control or control over our money or our spendings or our earnings, then a loss of control with our money or our spendings can make us feel unsafe or insecure. And we know that when we feel unsafe, anxiety can develop to buffer this threat. And then what that can do is create a really complex or stressful relationship with money, because a lot of people do see money as either security and stability and control, or on the flip side, instability, out of control, fear, you know, if you feel like you don't have control over money. And I do want to have a little caveat here and say, obviously, money is so different for different population groups. Privilege does come into this as well. But I think when we talk about money, we're talking about our sense of control or lack of control with money and earnings and those things. So our financial well-being and mental health are really closely linked. I mean, think about it as you're speaking about aims. When we are feeling stressed or we feel there's a lack of control over our money, we are less likely to want to go out, right? Those things, social connection, we know how important that is for our mental health. When we are feeling anxious around money, we may withdraw. If we're feeling anxious around money, we may become impulsive and spend a lot of money, and then that may create guilt. So you can see how they're very closely linked, our financial well-being and mental health. So what impacts, as you said, Ames, our relationship with money? You know, so many different things. I think the first thing that I want to note was what was modeled to us growing up. I think certainly if how our parents, you know, worked with money, how they spent money, how they earned money, how they talked about money or didn't talk about money, actually, I think that's a really key learning experience that we learn from our caregivers, is how was money viewed? Was money feared? Was money avoided? Was money openly spoken about? I think those things really can create our framework for how then we view money and how we feel around money as adults. One thing to note is what else can impact our relationship with money. I've noticed that when working with some clients or those who've experienced maybe in their early childhood, you know, trauma, those who experience inconsistent housing environments, those who experienced maybe perhaps more homelessness, or those who experience low socioeconomic status or poverty, then sometimes what can happen if you've experienced any distress or any inconsistent parenting or inconsistent environments through your childhood is that can create that need for control, that can increase our importance around control. And so often not just how it was modeled to us, but what we experienced growing up. And there is a correlation with inconsistent childhood, whether it was an unsafe childhood, whether you experienced trauma, with perhaps more increased need for control when dealing with money as an adult, because that gives you that sense of control that you felt like perhaps you didn't have growing up. So there is a link with, I guess, not just what was modeled to us, but what we experienced, the safety or the lack of safety, and how that can impact on our money and our feelings around money growing up. What about you, Ames? What do you feel like impacts our relationship with money?
I agree. I think childhood, as with all relationships, our money relationships develop from our experiences in childhood. Sometimes we can refer to negative experiences or unsafe, inconsistent experiences with money as money wounds that we carry from earlier in life, where you may have experienced scarcity and developed a scarcity mindset. As Kat was saying, sometimes control can be an adaptive coping strategy to essentially give us a pseudo sense of certainty and predictability. control really functions to give us a sense of certainty and safety in an otherwise inconsistent or insecure environment. So that can really come from experiences due to financial limitations, or perhaps you might have internalized your parents' stress in regard to money and learned not to need too much. When it comes to having a bit of a scarcity mindset, sometimes what you can learn is not to take anything because there's not enough to go around. And sometimes that's where guilt and shame can really develop as part of your internal working model. It might feel like you are burdening your parents for asking for what you need. As a child, you might have felt like, oh, I can't ask to go to things like dance lessons, or I can't ask for that new toy because I understand how stressed and worried my parents are about money, and that feels like I'm asking for too much. And what that can mean is in adulthood, you can have a lot of guilt around spending money on things, regardless of how much you make. That money wound, it's like a little emotional trigger point that gets poked on that still exists. So trauma can be quite pervasive, because when experiencing trauma, or that response, trauma isn't necessarily what happens to us, but rather what happens inside us. Our capacity to cope with trauma sometimes leads to the development of maybe coping mechanisms that aren't the most helpful or aren't serving us as well. And I guess this is the flip side of trauma when it comes to our relationship with money. So trauma essentially is like having constant stress, like Kat mentioned, something that causes us to have a response of distress. So we have a lot of stress living in our body. Essentially, without going into it too much, it means that our body and our brain are constantly in a state of fight, flight, freeze. And this constant stress state means that stress hormones are higher throughout the body, resulting in increased inflammation, decreased immunity, and that's what we refer to when we're referring to kind of toxic stress or trauma response. So this might mean that the person experiencing trauma has, I guess, a bit of an inhibited ability to or capacity to make decisions around spending money. So it might mean that you become a little bit more compulsive or really rigid. So if you are in that fight, flight state or that hyper aroused state, it might mean that you are extremely rigid and controlled with money, because it feels like your safety net. It feels like life and death, essentially. Or it might mean that you are extremely impulsive and engage in essentially risky behavior around money. And that might be a bit of a familiar pattern to you. So it can lead to a plethora of habits and behaviors that serve to keep you safe, that have, I guess, protective intentions, but perhaps negatively impact our money habits and our management of money. I guess additionally, spending money can be a means of temporary relief or escapism from stress as well. I think as a child too, one thing to note is our coping strategies. So as a child, for example, if you predominantly coped with dissociation or a shutdown response, it makes sense that you cope with your financial stress by avoiding or shutting down emotionally. So learning to view financial mistakes or financial challenges through this lens can be really helpful in seeing them with a more compassionate lens. So as Kat was mentioning, we can often feel quite shamed and a lot of guilt around difficulty navigating money. And so I think oftentimes really understanding where your money behaviors or patterns around how you relate to money come from, it can often unburden you from shame and develop or allow you space to develop more helpful coping strategies. So I think the biggest money wound that I see is the nature of trust with self. This can really come up in terms of our relationship with money. So often it can feel like, I can never trust myself with money. I never feel safe. So I think understanding why your relationship with money is the way that it is helps you to see your financial challenges with a little bit more of an empowered lens as well. So it can empower us to start repairing that relational rupture rather than avoiding it and just seeing it as a wrong thing about me. Also, one thing that I wanted to add here when it comes to relationship with money, and I'm interested to get your opinion on this, Kat, is the role of social media. Mm-hmm. I think this definitely comes up a lot. I think personally for me, also what I hear working with clients as well, is that things have never been more accessible, for one. you know, literally we are bombarded with links to things all the time, like ads, and also that comparison of, you know, everything for the gram and needing things like, you know, a fresh outfit if you're going to all those social events, that almost like competitive nature that social media can have. What have you noticed with that, Kat?
Yeah, it's interesting that you do bring that up because, you know, one thing that can impact on our relationship with money is our relationship with self, right? And I think if you're someone who maybe experiences low self-worth or has, you know, something like body dysmorphia or disordered eating habits, or you do often find yourself comparing yourself to others, then you can imagine that by viewing social media, that, as we've spoken about in many episodes before, but the constant stream of images really starts to trick your brain into thinking that all of these things are normal, normalized. So expensive holidays are normalized, what we look like normalized, beautiful clothes are normalized. And so what that may do is create this sense of, I want to buy that so I can look like that. I want to buy that so I can experience that. I want to buy that so my life can look like that. And I think it is a bit of a vicious cycle, isn't it? That the constant needing to look like that or buy that thing. And I think Instagram, it's very accessible, but it's very quick. Like, it's quite convenient to tap on that product. And I've noticed, you know, how they have those product things now. You can just literally tap on the photo, go straight to the website and check out. And I think it can take you like less than 30 seconds to buy something. So if you're someone who struggles with impulse control, social media can be a really, really tough storm to navigate. Particularly, I would say people who do suffer from, you know, something like ADHD or BPD, we know that there's an inherently less ability or less able to control impulses. So you can imagine scrolling Instagram is literally just like screaming out, buy this, get that. And it's incredibly difficult to control that and to say no. And even if you don't have a clinical diagnosis of those things, impulse control on social media really takes some skill, right? Especially if you're someone that may want to look a certain way or may be influenced by social media more so than others. So I think social media plays a huge role. I think social media plays a huge role in literally everything in our life at the moment, but is certainly with our spending habits. And I think we'll get into that later, but really unpacking the motivation underneath it, because I think there's so much more to money, isn't there, than just spending and earning money. There's so many layers underneath our spending habits and our fear or our feelings around money. And I think it's really interesting when looking at consumer habits. You know, there are people out there who are employed to look at consumer habits to actually target impulsivity, to target us on social media. So it can be a tough place to navigate when you're someone who has a stressful relationship with money.
Absolutely. And speaking of fears, I think fear of missing out or FOMO really can be tricky to navigate here, especially with social media and how accessible spending money can be. I think that feeling of pressure really creeps in here. And I think social media makes you feel like you need things that you might not otherwise feel like you need. When it comes to comparison or that fear of missing out. So people end up spending money on things that don't necessarily align to their values or don't necessarily make them feel good long term. But it's that, you know, kind of pressure or fear of missing out that make you feel like, okay, I must have this now. And I think that can be really, really tricky as well. And one thing that you mentioned, Kat, was impulse control. I think what's really interesting when looking at something like bipolar, for example, is that a lot of research has shown that it's not just impulsivity or high energy or nervous energy that leads to difficulty with making financial decisions. It can also be when we're feeling really low and flat as kind of a self-soothing or comforting practice. So I think there can be a plethora of emotional states that we can go through where comparison can really wreak havoc on our decision-making when it comes to spending. And I think we can effectively self-sabotage our own financial self-care when it comes to things like experiencing social media comparisons or social comparisons. I mean, social comparison is inevitable because it's part of an evolutionary response. You know, we want to track how we're going in comparison to others to make sure we're living well, to make sure we're surviving. So I think that's really important to pay attention to as well, is like Kat was saying, our motivation. You know, what's making us feel like we want to buy something? Is it coming from that, you know, like, oh, I feel like I'm missing out, or I feel like I need to have what they have to avoid perhaps making a decision that's going to hurt us in the long term?
Yeah, and it's so interesting, Ames, you mentioned the reward system when we buy something, because you're right, it may be a result of maybe impulse or lack thereof, impulse control, but you're right, a lot of our spending habits seems to be around instant gratification, which really under the surface is our reward system, right? Our reward system, like ding, 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 this feels really good in the short term, right? It's just like drugs, it's food, it's all of those things that give us a short-term reward. And, you know, it was so interesting as you're saying that, I had this like flashback of when I was at uni, and I remember doing assignments, and I used to have this really strange pattern of behavior, which really reflecting on it now makes sense, where if I was doing an assignment or if I was working really hard at uni, I'd have this need to buy something. It was almost like my own reward. Even though I hadn't finished the thing, it's almost like I can't keep working on this until I have this short-term boost of serotonin. Like perhaps it was a mood booster. And I remember thinking, like, that's such a strange pattern of behavior for someone, you know, who doesn't have a lot of money at uni. But I remember thinking, like, this is whether it was stimulation, it was excitement, it was reward. And I think it's interesting. I wonder if other people do feel like this, of this is such a short-term gratification. When things in life don't feel like they're very gratifying, when you're feeling quite monotonous, when work feels draining, when your serotonin maybe isn't being boosted by anything that you're doing, you know, shopping and spending is such, you know, a quick way to do that for so many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that dopamine can be so addictive. Yeah, it is like what comes up for me is treat yourself. Yeah, like, oh, I've had a really hard week. I'm going to go shopping and treat myself to make myself feel better. And retail therapy is a legit thing because it does do that. Yeah, we do. We get that little boost of dopamine. We feel better temporarily for the short term. And so it becomes like a little reward. It becomes like a little treat. And I often used to say that, I still do say that. I'm just going to go and treat myself. So true.
We did have to have a word when you moved into your new place. You were like, help, SOS.
Absolutely. That financial self-care.
Really formed the inspo for the episode. It's so difficult, isn't it? Yeah, the treat yourself mentality. It's certainly something that we all experience.
Absolutely. So, impact of money spending and finances on mental health. Why is it that being in a financial difficult state, in a financial pickle, affects our mental health so much? Why do so many people with depression and anxiety symptoms also experience money stress? This is a really difficult relationship that I really think works both ways. Like I said before, is it a case of the chicken or the egg? I think sometimes when we experience symptoms of depression and anxiety, it can really hamper our ability to look after our financial area of well-being. And having financial stress can bring on symptoms of depression and anxiety, along with other psychological symptoms, you know, like stress. And I think, you know, one thing that I really think of when we talk about the impact of money spending and finances on mental health is how much debt you're in. I read a study that said if you are in debt, you are more than 3 times likely to experience anxiety, depression, drug and alcohol dependency. You're at greater risk of an eating disorder and overall poor mental health. And that blew my mind because I think in our day and age, not to sound old, but in our day and age, the cost of living is so high that I think I don't know anyone that isn't in some kind of debt. I'm in debt, and I know sometimes I can get really stressed about how am I going to pay this off? Am I going to pay off in time? How much interest is this incurring? How much debt is too much debt? All of these questions. So research also shows that it's not necessarily how much debt you have that has the biggest impact on how you cope with financial stress, but how you make sense of having debt and whether you feel like you can get by day to day and whether you feel like it will improve. So hope here is a really important key player. And as you mentioned, Kat, I guess sense of control and agency is a key component as well. Am I going to be able to get out of this? Am I going to be able to manage okay? And I think that is a really important thing when it comes to the impact of finances on mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think as well, something to note here is connection. I feel like spending money off, you know, really maintains a sense of connection. I mean, think about even just going out with your friends, you spend money a lot of the time, right? A lot of social events are centered around spending some kind of money. Mm. Memories, holidays are centered on finances. Also, I was thinking of something as you're speaking, Ames. If your love language is gift giving, like that is your way of maintaining connection with someone and showing love. So you can imagine that gift giving is sometimes can be expensive. And so I wonder if, you know, something that can happen if you're not spending money or if you're, you know, trying not to spend money, you're sticking to a budget. I wonder if you feel less connected to others. I wonder if you feel that impacts on your ability to show love or to receive love. I'd be curious about that because for people whose love language may be gift giving, it is a bid for connection, right? It's their way of connecting and showing love. So if you take that away, I'd be curious to know. And also another thing to note is people pleasing. People pleasing can come into this as well. People pleasers may feel this need to go above and beyond and treat other people to, yeah, maybe maintain connection, to avoid conflict, you know, those things that might come up for people pleasers. So I think those things may be interesting things to note if you do experience, you know, maybe if you feel like you're a people pleaser or if you're a gift giver, I wonder if, you know, how that might impact on your financial situation.
Mm. We're really struggling to set those financial boundaries for your financial self-care. If you're a gift giver or a people pleaser, you might spend money to your own detriment because you want to show others love. That's one way that it can really impact in interpersonal relationships. And I think too, absolutely increases feelings of isolation, which can be a big problem for people who do experience depression. And it can also increase depression, that feeling of disconnection and isolation. Mm. So again, that double-edged sword, which makes social connection really difficult and increases shame. Acts of service too can come in here, but gift giving, people pleasing, if we're unable to do the things that we feel allow us to feel worthy and valuable and accepted and reassured and approved of in relationships, it is, I'm doing a wrong thing, or I can't do the thing that allows me to feel loved and valuable. So then I just feel bad. So shame is a really important factor when it comes to the complex relationship between money and mental health, because then we feel like we're failed. No, I'm letting you down. I'm disappointing you. I'm not able to do the things that I'm meant to be able to do. Which again really goes back to that core of sense of self and value. I think social status too. I think money is a huge marker of social status, and that can induce a lot of feelings around worry and stress and anxiety and how we feel about ourselves, and a marker of achievement.
Yeah, marker of achievement, validation. Mm. You know, I guess going back to that social media link, if you feel as though you're getting the things or looking like you're living this your best life, then that validation it feels good, but it's short term. It's the reward system again.
I guess just as we're talking, another thing that just popped into my mind is the impact of money on mental health might also be your capacity to access support. So if financial stress is a really significant challenge for you, you might avoid accessing psychological support because it's too expensive. And if you're not able to go to work because of a mental health condition or you know, anything really that might be a barrier in stopping you from being able to work, that can also play into how you access support and learn to move through some of these financial stresses. And that can be huge because it can mean that then you're stuck in this vicious cycle. And, you know, perhaps avoidance is a huge thing when it comes to financial stress. Mm-hmm. It grows bigger and bigger and bigger. What we resist persists, which means then it can be a bit of a dark hole we fall into.
Yeah, you've really just described the cycle of poverty, right? Like that. Low SES, if you are someone who experiences low SES situations, of course your mental health will decline because they're so interlinked, aren't they? You can't access services and even beyond mental health services, health services, you know, you can't access education. You may not be able to access the higher paying jobs, right? So you're right. It is a bit of a vicious cycle. And I guess as we're talking, it makes sense, right? Money isn't just money. There's so much more to our relationship with money and how it impacts on us that I guess isn't really widely spoken about, you know. One really quick study I wanted to mention was actually, Ames, you'd be interested in this, the correlation between attachment style and financial behavior. So a 2015 study were exploring this and they wanted to know if attachment style correlated or impacted on people's financial behaviors. So a lot of the studies I found around this were actually interestingly in universities, so studying university students, and they found that firstly, those who experienced anxious or avoidant attachment styles, symptoms of anxiety and dyslexia were more likely to avoid discussion and exhibit avoidance around finances, or were more likely to report an anxious relationship with money. Picking back off this study, it was another study done 5 years later, and it found similarly that those with a higher attachment anxiety or those who felt more anxious in their relationship, so this was more of a focus on an anxious attachment, were more likely to experience and report financial instability and dissatisfaction. And I found that interesting because, you know, even going back to how we, you know, the attachment is really how we express and show love, right? And you can see how much of an impact that money, something we wouldn't necessarily always correlate with, you know, our love and our attachment model with money. And I think it's interesting to note that, Ames, you'd probably be the spokesperson for this, but attachment is such a domino effect, isn't it? Into not just our romantic relationships, but into, you know, so many caveats and so many parts of our life. So I thought that was really interesting. There's actually not a lot on, that would be a really cool thing to study, attachment styles and financial behavior.
Yeah, it would. And I think it obviously, that makes a lot of sense to me, given that our attachment is like our internal working model. Mm. So it is literally our map of how we relate to everything in the world. Mm. It's biological. So it's programmed, wired into us from infancy. So of course, it's going to affect any relationship we have, whether it be with ourselves or how we relate to someone else in terms of finances. And I think when we talk about attachment, we're essentially talking about our fundamental attachment needs. So needs for safety, security, need to feel heard, seen, important, validated, all of those things. And money contributes to a lot of that. So it does. It makes a lot of sense.
Mm, absolutely. And I think when anxiety comes into control, right? Like there's so many interlinking parts here. So then in saying that, Ames, talk to me, how can we practice financial care? So now we know what it is and now we know how it's formed and why we need it. How can we then practice financial self-care?
Good question. I think when talking about how to practice financial self-care, I kind of have a bit of a two-pronged approach. I think firstly, really understanding perhaps some of your financial habits in relation to trauma and attachment, in relation to some of your past experiences is always a really good place to start. Because I think first, before we can repair or affect healthy, positive change, we really need to have a solid understanding of how we are the way that we are and why things are the way that they are. And I think that can also be really validating and allow us to have a little bit more of a compassionate approach to self. Like I was saying before, I think that can really help with some of the other impacts that a poor financial relationship can have, like experiences of shame and guilt, depression and anxiety. So I think first, maybe seeking support if that rings true to you. Perhaps if you have absorbed financial stress from your parents and you've noticed, scarcity mindset sounds a little bit familiar. Maybe speaking to someone about that, and that could be a really great place to start. I think also, adding relaxation techniques to a daily routine can be really helpful because, as we've discussed, stress, anxiety, control play such a huge role in how we relate to money. So I think just as a little practical tip there, learning how to regulate emotions and your nervous system and in turn, I guess that can really help with avoidance. That's really, really intrinsic to recovery from not only trauma, but I guess healing the relationship with money or money wounds. I think it's actually a critical piece of the financial relationship puzzle there. And I think also too, it's very natural and normal to want to avoid things that we're fearful of. So acknowledging that, yeah, this is going to be really scary. This is going to be going near all of the things that I have been able to avoid for probably a really long time. So I think having that acknowledgement and, you know, really giving yourself time to celebrate taking a bit of a first step, as cheesy as that might sound, can also be a wonderful way to break through the barriers of shame and fear and really get you on, you know, that first step to feel really comfortable in talking to someone, because yeah, there might be a little bit of embarrassment and shame and uncertainty around what that all looks like, and it can feel really overwhelming. So I think, yeah, that can be a really helpful first step. And then I think, again, practically, perhaps once that is addressed and feels a little bit less overwhelming and daunting and scary, again, just as a practical tip, having a really good plan. I think planning out what you value, what is important to you financially, can be really, really helpful. So pausing to plan can be really helpful. Identify what you're worried about in terms of money. So maybe where some of those anxieties are coming from, and making a plan to buffer and I guess have a little bit of a, yeah, almost like a little bit of a safety net there for yourself when it comes to financial self-care. And I guess, Kat, I will leave impulse control and discipline and all of those things up to you. I'm sure you have a lot to say for that, but I think that would be, those would be my top tips. Starting with childhood, I think that's always, I guess I'm a little bit biased there. It's not always, but my personal suggestion for how to improve financial self-care would be first starting with childhood attachment and experiences of trauma, understanding that. I think that can be really great for repairing the relationship you have with money in terms of not only how you see yourself, but as seeing your situation with money as much less one of shame and something being wrong with you, and coming from a much more empowered place of feeling like you're able to affect change.
Yeah, I love that, Ames. I think creating safety around money again, I think that's a really helpful way, reframing the way you look at money, because I think a lot of avoidance and also rigidity around money comes from fear. So the antidote to fear is to create safety and to rethink how you view money, because money is neutral, right? It's the way we look at it that is different for everyone. It's our emotions and feelings we have towards it. It's our feel of safety or unsafety we have towards it. I think piggybacking off that, just maybe asking yourself some questions, you know, as Ames said, what is your relationship with money? Where did that start? What have you learned along the way? Where did you get that mindset from? How does money play a part in your life? Do you feel as though money is helpful in, you know, working through and achieving your goals? Or do you feel like it's a hindrance? Is it something that you think about all the time and you worry about a lot of the time? Do you feel you have control over money, or do you feel this lack of control, this complete lack of control? Do you feel passive to your money? Do you avoid money? Do you avoid talking about money? Do you avoid looking at your bank statements? I know I do sometimes. If you do avoid money, what feeling are you actually avoiding? Because there's a feeling you're avoiding. Is it shame, as Ames said? Is it guilt? Is it embarrassment? Is it worry? Do you have fear around losing money? Do you feel that you maybe sacrifice enjoyment of life because you're worried about losing money? Do you have a scarcity mindset? Yeah. I think, you know, we deserve financial freedom. I think that's the premise of the episode that we wanted to talk about, is financial self-care is also a feeling of control, something that we find really helpful. And I think for so many people, finances and money feels so out of control sometimes. It feels so overwhelming. Ames, you're spot on. The cost of living is overwhelming. It feels so out of our control. And so many people have that very similar feelings around money. I think the plan is fantastic. I think one thing to note before making a bit of a plan is looking at your patterns. Do you notice that you spend more, or do you notice that you have, you know, different things go in and out of your account at different times? I know for me, when it's coming up to my period, I tend to spend more. That's something I've noticed within myself, whether it is a dopamine, whether it's a serotonin comfort, who knows. Do you notice that you are someone who buys things for others to diffuse conflict? Are you someone who gives gifts? How does that impact on your financial self-care? Motivations under your purchases. Why are you buying this certain thing, right? Is it for validation? Is because you like this thing? It's because you want to go on that holiday? It's because you think, you know, this is the luxurious holiday you deserve. Impulse control is really important. I think when working through impulse control, it's not as simple as saying, just don't do it. Impulse control is a skill. It really is so difficult to manage, especially if you are someone who is neurodivergent or you experience personality disorders. It really can be quite difficult, or even anxiety disorders, to be honest. So working on your impulse control, learning more about yourself, giving yourself the compassion, and then having some steps forward to reflect on, you know, your money and your financial self-care. I think really, as we always say, speaking to someone about it, if you're someone who feels some worry or shame or anxiety around your money, it's a really good place to start with opening up. You know, therapy is a great place. There's lots of financial counselors. There's lots of financial supports. I know I was just researching. I know Centrelink has I forget what it's called, but there's a hotline you can call if you're experiencing any financial, you know, anxieties and you need some support. So I think finances are such a multi-pronged approach, James. As you said before, right? It's money, but that it's also the psychological impacts and our views of money that's important. So I think both of those things need to be addressed when looking at your financial self-care. It's setting aside time to look over things, to set aside a budget. And as well, if money feels a bit out of control, it's like, well, who can you ask for some help? I think support is so important here. And how can you increase a sense of control with your money? I think that's really the crux of what I think would be important, is how can you take money from this really overwhelming trigger to feeling in control of this again, and improving your agency around money. It's just like any other self-care practices, and it's called a self-care practice because it takes practice. It takes time to build up the skills and to learn about your own, you know, self-care practices. And I think finance is just one of those things where it's not always glamorous setting a budget. It's not always relaxing as getting a massage or participating in leisure activities, but it's so, so important. It is so, so important that you feel some sense of control and agency over your finances, because that then impacts, has a huge domino effect, like we've spoken about, to your well-being. So I hope that was helpful. Ames, do you want to add anything else?
I think you nailed it. Love those tips. Okay.
Well, guys, we hope that was helpful. We do thank you for tuning in to our first episode back of 2022. We are so excited to bring you more eps this year, and we'll be back. We are recording every 3 weeks now, so you'll be hearing from us every couple of weeks. Ames, our next episode, we haven't decided on. I always say that. I'm like, what is our next episode? We haven't figured it out. But you can find us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters, or on our therapy Instagram, which is at The Psych Collaborative. You can go and find more content there. Ames is the social media whiz behind The Psychology Sisters. She posts such wonderful stuff, so highly recommend. Ames also did a post around financial anxiety, which was really fantastic. So Ames, well done on that post. All right, guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you next episode. Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're not already, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. We are also now providing online psychological sessions. For more information, please follow us at The Psych Collaborative. See you next time.